Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. Over 600 million acres of land is owned collectively by the American people. What is the history of public lands? And how is the contemporary discourse about public lands framed by this history? Doug Becker explores with the author of a new book on the history of public lands in the U.S.
I'm Doug Becker. Over 600 million acres of land in the United States is currently collectively owned by the American people as public lands. This is roughly 30% of the total land of the nation. On today's show, we will explore the history of these public lands, the meaning behind collectively owned lands, and how the lands in 2022 stand on the historical record. Our guest is John Leshy. He's emeritus professor at the University of California Hastings College of Law in San Francisco. He's the author of a new book, which is our focus this week, Our Common Ground, A History of America's Public Lands. Professor Leshy, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me. Delighted to be here.
Thank you. So I guess my first question is, public lands are clearly a reality. That number actually kind of surprised me that about 30% of the nation's lands are currently held in public. How historical is this? Does this go back to the founding of the Republic, or is this a relatively recent development?
Well, it's kind of both. My book opens with the beginning of the public lands, which actually dates back to shortly after the Declaration of Independence. And the events around that time actually illustrate a theme that runs throughout my history. So my history starts there, and it starts because there were 13 original colonies declaring their independence from Britain, and seven of them had claims to Western lands across the Appalachians, and six did not. And they got in a big tussle over this. And it held up the formation of the national government for years until they resolved this dispute, and they resolved it by the states with the claims giving them up to the national government. So the national government took basically control of the lands west of the Appalachians. And that was the beginning of the nation's public lands. Now, the core of my story really begins in about 1890, because that's when, about 100 years later, that's when the United States really made a collective decision to keep a lot of lands in national ownership permanently and to manage them for broad public purposes, recreation, conservation, and the like. So most of my book deals with the political events from 1890 onward, but the history goes back really to the beginning. And the beginning illustrates this theme that the public lands, while they have this kind of popular conception of a divisive force, they actually almost always operated to bring people together, to bring the nation together. And that was demonstrated at the beginning, and it's been demonstrated over and over since.
So in the 1890s, this becomes an even more salient political movement, because when I think of public lands and legislative action on public lands, usually the first name that comes to mind for me is Theodore Roosevelt. So is Roosevelt responding, you know, to public pressures, or how much is he shaping the way in which we view public lands within the country?
It's both, actually. Before 1890, there were a couple of instances where Congress decided to keep lands in national ownership. Yosemite in California, and Yellowstone, which was the world's first national park. That was in 1872. But around 1890, as a reaction to the sort of vast giveaways that took place after the Civil War, the people through the Congress decided, hey, we don't want to give all this stuff away. We want to really start keeping a lot of it systematically. And so Congress passed laws in 1890 and 1891, which authorized the president to set aside a reserve public lands in public ownership. Now, that was 11 years before Roosevelt became president. And so Roosevelt was really a part of a continuity. He didn't invent this stuff. It was well underway before he took office. Having said that, it's also clear from the historical record that Theodore Roosevelt had an enormous impact himself, because he really set aside a lot of lands for lots of different broad public purposes. But he wasn't acting alone. He wasn't originating. He was part of a trend.
It seems like the idea that the public collectively owns land is ideologically opposed to the notion of, you know, private property, of capitalism. I mean, nowadays, you know, even the idea that, you know, collective ownership, maybe government ownership, might even face accusations that it's socialist in nature. Is there a tension between the long history of capitalism, you know, in the United States and this idea of collective ownership of land?
Well, I explore this theme, you know, throughout the book, and it is an underlying theme. But I think if you look at public lands today, 600 million acres, more than 30% of the country, it's not a socialist enterprise in the classic sense. There's enormous opportunities for private enterprise to operate on public lands. I mean, if you've ever been to a national park, you know there are park concessions, private corporations, you know, running campgrounds and hotels and things like that. And so the public lands are an enormous economic force locally in many areas where they exist in large numbers and produce lots of jobs, et cetera. So it's a marriage of the public and the private. The public ownership sort of sets the tone and the objectives for how we're going to manage this stuff. But then a lot of the actual implementation, particularly for recreation and for things like logging and mining, which takes place on some public lands, that's all operated through private enterprise. So it's not pure socialism, and never has been. The 1890 date, this beginning, was really in large part a reaction to the kind of Gilded Age, what Mark Twain called the Gilded Age, which was where large corporations sort of had their will and were unregulated and, you know, did some good things, but also did some not so good things. And there was a public reaction to that. So the public lands were part of that reaction.
This is a model then that suggests it's capitalist, but there's government oversight, maybe management, et cetera. And so I know there's four agencies that are responsible at this point. How do those agencies differ? Are policies pretty well coordinated? And what are those four?
Yes, there are four principal public land management agencies. The well-known one is the National Park Service, U.S. Forest Service, the United States Fish and Wildlife Service, and then the most obscure, but the one that actually manages more land than the rest is the Bureau of Land Management. Three of those agencies are in the Department of the Interior. The Forest Service and the Department of Agriculture each manage 100 million plus acres of land. One of the big modern stories that I talk about quite a bit in the book for the end is the fact that, you know, there are a lot of histories that have been written of particular places on the public lands or particular agencies, history of the Park Service, history of the Forest Service, that sort of thing. My book is really the first one in a very long time, maybe ever, that has looked at all the public lands collectively. And the reason that's important, I think, is because increasingly in modern times, they're all managed similarly by similar processes and for similar objectives. There are degrees of difference among the agencies, but those differences have been blurred and obscured over the last few decades. Deliberately, Congress has really made a deliberate choice that, you know, these lands should all be managed. They're all open for recreation, for example. And recreation is a dominant use of all of these lands, regardless of which agency manages them. And Congress has come along. The big step here was in 1964. Congress enacted what was called the Wilderness Act, which said, we're going to set aside large tracts of these public lands, basically to maintain them in their natural condition. We're not going to allow highways. We're not going to allow motor vehicles. We're not going to allow logging. We're not going to allow mining. And Congress said each agency is going to manage wilderness areas, and each agency does. So it's not a monopoly of the Park Service or the Forest Service. All agencies manage wilderness areas, and Congress gets to decide which lands actually are put into the wilderness system. So that idea of blurring the functions of the agencies is a modern trend. And I think the American people support that. They understand that, actually. I think more and more American people think of the public lands as this common ground. Yeah, some of them managed by the Park Service, some of them managed by the Forest Service, but they're all managed and open to all and largely managed the same.
Actually painting a little bit of a different picture than what immediately comes to mind when I think of public lands. I think of public lands, I think of lands that are set aside. We're not going to develop these. We're not going to use these. Certainly some of the focus of that, think of, you know, philosophies like, and thinkers like John Muir talking about, you know, the need to preserve the beauty of the country and we need to set this aside. So I imagine that's one of the motivations, but is it fair to say that isn't necessarily necessarily the primary motivation, you know, behind public lands?
The motivation has changed gradually over the course of time. Initially, it was the 1890 decisions were to conserve open space, to conserve it for public inspiration and recreation, and to preserve water supplies. A lot of the early national forests set aside in the 1890s, for example, were in the upper reaches of the western watersheds. And the idea was we need to preserve those water supplies because the water is vital for use downstream. And that was an original motivation. But the idea of just open space and preservation more or less in natural condition, and to preserve the history and the culture and the archaeological sites and that sort of thing that are found on these lands for public education and for science, that's also been a motivation all along.
Is it fair to say that this is a bigger issue because there tends to be more public lands in the western part of the country? And how much is there a discrepancy between the western part of the country and other parts of the country as far as how much of the land is actually publicly owned?
Good question. Predominantly, they're in the west, but by no means all. And one of the interesting stories, which I talk about a good deal in the book, is how at the same time Congress said, we're going to set aside these upper forested areas in the west, Congress launched a program to, in the East, South, and Midwest, to go buy back land that had passed into private ownership to create an Eastern and Southeastern and New England National Forest system. I mean, there are quite a few federal lands there that were all bought back into public ownership, beginning with the so-called Weeks Act of 1911. Same thing is true, the national parks that you find in the East, Everglades, Big Bend in Texas, Great Smokies, those were all acquired by the United States beginning in the early part of the 20th century. And, you know, another theme of the book, which this illustrates, is, you know, there's this sort of myth out there that the feds grabbed all this land over the opposition of the states and the local communities and that sort of thing. That rarely happened. In fact, the opposite almost always happened, which was local communities and states petitioned for this. The Weeks Act that was passed in 1911 was asked for by the South and New England states together, said, we want the government to come in and national government and buy these lands. They've been logged over, they're eroding, they're exacerbating floods, et cetera. We want these lands restored and we want the national government to come in and buy them. Big Bend in Texas, we think of Texas as rugged independence, et cetera, hating the feds and all that. The lands in Big Bend were bought by the state of Texas and donated to the national government to create the national park. That was done in the 1930s. Something very similar happened in the Everglades in South Florida. So these political deals basically that created these lands in other parts of the country were strongly supported by and engineered by and petitioned for by the local communities and the states.
You raise an interesting question then, because when you think about the tension, you know, potentially the tension between local communities and the federal government, this is also reflected in some of the partisan discourses where the perception, particularly in 2022, is that Democrats that tend to be more supportive of federal powers are more supportive of public lands, where Republicans, and frequently citing that argument that there needs to be local control of these lands, tend to be opposed to that. I guess the first question is this historically been the discourse, or is this a relatively recent development? And then the second is, how accurate is that description?
Well, I'm glad you asked that question, because the history is quite clear that these efforts that date back to 1890 and so were almost all bipartisan. It was never a partisan issue. And if you look at, for example, the presidents who in succession created the National Forest System, there were two Republicans and two Democrats. Theodore Roosevelt was a Republican. Franklin Roosevelt, a Democrat, also had enormous impact on public lands. And if you look at the authors of the Wilderness Act in 1964, one of the prominent ones who drafted and really strongly supported it was a guy named John Saylor, very few people ever heard of, a very conservative Republican from Pennsylvania. And he was a very green Republican. In fact, his biography is called Green Republican. And this was typical. Now, in modern times, we tend to think of everything as red and blue and partisan and we fight over everything. The public lands, even in modern times, are mostly an exception to that. And I can give you many examples I give in the book. President Trump, for example, made headlines when he shrank or downsized a protected area of public lands in Utah, the so-called Bears Ears National Monument, got lots of headlines. But he also signed into law two major pieces of public land protection legislation that were regarded as the most significant pieces of public lands protection in the last several decades. Trump also, when he came into office, said, I want to review all of the recent protective actions that presidents have done with an eye toward undoing them all. And he left them all in place except these two in Utah for kind of peculiar reasons. President Biden restored the cuts that Trump had made. And the truth underlying this is demonstrated in every opinion poll taken over the last 30 or 40 years. In Western states, for example, public lands are overwhelmingly popular and protecting them is overwhelmingly popular. And when Trump went out and said, I'm going to review all these protected area orders, the overwhelming public response was, leave them alone, we like them. And he left them almost all alone and then signed into law these pieces of legislation that actually are resulting in protecting more public lands. So simple public perception is very wrong. It's wrong historically, and I think it's still wrong today.
You're listening to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. We're discussing a new book, Our Common Ground, A History of America's Public Lands, with its author, Professor John Leshy. John, one of the more interesting recent developments on, you know, questions of public land has been Biden's, you know, choice to head the Department of the Interior. Deb Haaland has raised these issues about the importance of indigenous communities, not just the question of indigenous rights with respect to these lands, but also just the way in which Native populations viewed the lands. Is it fair to say that our contemporary conception of these lands really do owe quite a debt to the influence coming from Native populations in the United States?
Absolutely. And, you know, the history by which Native indigenous peoples in North America were dispossessed, were basically, you know, thrown off those lands, is you know, obviously full of injustice and iniquity and that sort of thing. It dates back to Columbus. I mean, you know, it's not something the United States government invented. This was something that was going on long before. And the history of that dispossession and the acquiring of clear title by the United States really almost always predated the stuff I'm talking about, because that was all over really in most parts of the country by shortly after the Civil War. And then it wasn't until really a generation after that that the United States said, well, hey, we have all this land. We're going to stop giving it all away. And now we're going to keep some of it. So it's a different story. I don't talk very much about the dispossession in the book, because it is that earlier episode. What I do talk about toward the end of the book, though, is what you were getting at in your question, which is in modern times, we are looking at these public lands differently, in part because of the influence of Native Americans. Now, as Native Americans gave up these lands, they didn't give up their ancestral ties to these lands, and they didn't give up their knowledge and understanding of these lands. And we are now, we, the majority society, is now sort of saying, hey, we have a lot to learn from these people, and they have a lot to contribute. And happily, the Native nations have been, particularly after World War II, got much better able to exercise influence. And I have a couple of long chapters toward the end of the book, which talk about this modern Native American influence. One place you can really see it is in this separate chapter I have on Alaska, where there are enormous amounts of federal land, and the Native claims to land in Alaska was actually never settled until 1971. I mean, it came very late in the process. And so the chapter on Alaska describes how the United States addressed the Native claims, and then almost at the same time said, and of the lands we're getting clear title to, we're going to manage almost all of those for conservation. And here's how we're going to do it. So that kind of happened parallel in Alaska. In the lower 48, though, there are a number of interesting instances recounted in my book where Native nations really said, we want some influence over how these lands are managed. And in some cases, our claim of being unfairly deprived of these lands is so strong, we want them back. And from time to time, Congress has done that. So that's an important part of the modern story. And, you know, one of the issues that is being talked about a lot now, for example, is managing lands, these large landscapes for fire, with regard to fire and fire danger and all that. And scientists are sort of waking up to the idea that, hey, actually, you know, the Native American treatment of lands from a fire standpoint is actually has lots of important lessons, and we should learn from them. And so there's a lot of exciting things happening in this area. And President Biden's naming of Deb Haaland as the Secretary of the Interior is really a momentous event, because it does kind of capture that evolving relationship. And she's obviously made this an important part of her tenure. And so it's kind of an exciting time to be involved in public land policy.
Another strong motivation in the protection of these public lands and the motivation for the public lands is just broadly on questions of environmental protection, you know, climate change, land degradation issues, biodiversity and preservation of species. How much has that historically been the case, a desire to have public lands in order to preserve those lands as a primary motivation? And has that grown over time?
Yes, it was a motivation at the beginning, and it's certainly grown over time. Now, the first large tracts of land set aside were set aside for scenery and inspiration, Yosemite, Yellowstone. But then, as I said earlier, in the 1890s, the emphasis was on, we want to protect watersheds. We want to preserve the water supplies and keep those lands healthy. And then 10 or so years later, the effort began to, we want to protect wildlife habitat. We want to protect the critters, the creatures that live on these lands. We want to protect biodiversity. They didn't call it biodiversity back then, but Theodore Roosevelt was a prime mover here, because he set aside the first lands specifically for wildlife protection. And that has grown over time into a whole big system of lands. More than 100 million acres are now in these national wildlife refuges. So it's been a part of the public land policy from the beginning, but certainly it has grown and strengthened over time. And Congress, for example, in the late 60s, early 70s, enacted the Endangered Species Act. Now, some of it applies on private land, but it also applies more strongly on public lands. And a lot of the species that are listed for protection under that act have primary habitats on public land. And that's an important driver of public land policy.
With respect to the public lands, as to who makes the decision about lands being set aside, kind of a classic, you know, constitutional question about, is it Congress, you know, is it the presidency? And there's been a number of examples where congressional representatives have complained the president has overreached. And in particular, I'm thinking of the Antiquities Act, the use of the Antiquities Act to try to protect certain public lands. First of all, do you have any specific cases? And I know you discussed some of those in the book. And generally speaking, is the question about how much protection there is for public lands really depends on, you know, who's the resident in the White House?
It's a very good question. And the answer has changed somewhat over the years in a surprising way, or a way that's surprising to most people. The Antiquities Act, passed in 1906 in Theodore Roosevelt's time, was a very broad transfer of decision-making authority to the president. Congress enacted it. Congress said, President, you are hereby authorized to set aside areas of public land for protection, to protect the objects of historic and scientific interest. That was the language of the act. And Roosevelt and all of his successors, almost all of his successors, Republican and Democrat, have used the Antiquities Act to set aside millions and millions of acres of land. And in fact, George W. Bush was the first to use it offshore in a major way. He set aside hundreds of millions of acres of submerged land as marine reserves offshore, using the Antiquities Act. So that was those were almost all presidential decisions that were exercising authority Congress had given them. Now, two things. One is Congress almost never interfered with those decisions. In fact, they usually reaffirmed them and endorsed them. And a very typical pattern, if you look at big national parks now, a very common history of those parks is they were first set aside by presidents under the Antiquities Act, and then Congress came along and said, hey, that was a great idea. We're actually going to put a national park label on this area, and we're going to enlarge it. That kind of thing happened over and over. So it was a cooperative enterprise between the president and the Congress. Now, in modern times, the Congress has actually recaptured a lot of that broad authority that it has previously delegated to the president. So we don't have acts like the Antiquities Act so much anymore. More and more, we have Congress coming along saying, hey, we want to protect this area. We're going to give it a label of National Conservation Area, and we want to protect that area. And so there's been more legislation in modern times, not unilateral presidential action. But in the long sweep of history, you know, these are all political decisions. Public lands are sometimes called political lands, and libertarians sort of use that word as a scornful term. You know, they're just political lands. Well, they are political lands. I'll be the first to concede it. They are controlled. The decisions are made through the political process. And my kind of principal conclusion from this long history is that if you look at the public lands today and look at the opinion polls where vast majority of Americans of both political parties say, we're very happy with these, but we like the fact that we have these public lands. We would not do away with them. It's a political success story. And frankly, you know, we need political success stories today. I think it's an important lesson. And an important kind of education for Americans to understand that the government can actually do good things and things that turn out right. And we should credit that when credit is due.
There's a perception that in particular over the course of the last few years, that there's been a drive towards greater private access to these public lands, more drilling, more mining operations, even questions of grazing. I think of the dispute, the Clive and Bundy dispute about, you know, the use of public lands for grazing, and the accusation that the government setting these asides are a violation of, you know, of freedoms. First of all, is that an accurate perception that there's been more encroachments on public lands in, say, the last 10 years than previously?
Not really. Actually, if you look at, and again, I have some chapters on this toward the end of the book, the intensive industrial uses of public lands have actually diminished over the last few decades. There was a big wave, for example, of logging, clear-cutting the national forest after World War II, all over the country, but particularly in the Pacific Northwest. And then that reached a kind of a peak in the 1980s and now has declined. So the amount of logging in the national forest today is, and for the last few decades, it's been about what it was before World War II. If you look at the number of acres leased for oil and gas, it's remained relatively stable, but the amount of actual oil and gas operations, the amount of land actually drilled, is a really pretty small percentage of the overall public lands. Grazing, livestock grazing is a little bit of an exception. More acres are grazed than all the other non-recreational uses put together, 250 million acres probably. Almost all the national forests and land managed by the Bureau of Land Management is grazed by livestock. And that has a long history that I go into in some detail. And that remains an important use of public lands. But the economic impact of that use locally compared to, let's say, recreation as an economic driver is greatly diminished. I mean, the public lands produce a tiny, tiny fraction of the meat we actually consume in this country. And if you look at almost any community in the West of any size, the economic contribution of the outdoor recreation industry is much greater than the livestock industry.
This is our last question. Looking at the history of the protection of these public lands and sort of the state of the debate, are there any pieces of legislation or any, you know, a policy changes that immediately stand out that we should consider enacting in, you know, 2022 to better preserve public lands?
Well, the good news is that Congress is beginning to take on some big challenges that lie ahead. What is wildfire and what to do about that? A big problem. That's not simply a public lands problem, as you know from recent fires that have taken place on private land, but it is a problem that's getting a lot of attention from Congress, and Congress is beginning to pour some significant money into that problem, which is a good thing. Congress is also one of the major statutes that President Trump signed into law was one that created a new program well-funded to restore infrastructure, particularly recreational infrastructure and the like on public lands to accommodate the hordes of visitors that are occurring. I mean, recreational use of the public lands has just exploded in the last 10, 20 years. And the pandemic kind of made it worse in the sense because, you know, last year, Zion National Park had 5 million visitors. They'd never come close to that before. Yellowstone had 1 million visitors in 1 month. That had never happened before. Now that places a stress on managers. It places a stress on the lands, and you need to make some hard decisions about how you manage these lands. And the agency's personnel have diminished over the last few decades, and that's one of the things that needs to be done. And Congress is now recognizing that, is to build these agencies back up so they can accommodate these challenges of recreational explosion, climate change, biodiversity stress, and all of that. The good news is public land management is actually a great bargain. I mean, the total budgets of those four agencies managing those lands is about 0.5% of the entire federal budget. And the total number of people, personnel, is about 3% of the total civilian workforce. So we've been managing these lands on the cheap, as it were, and Congress is now waking up to that fact and beginning to address it. So I'm pretty hopeful about the future, even though there are big challenges ahead, particularly the changing climate challenge.
The issue is the protection of public lands, 600 million acres, over 600 million acres in the US, about 30% of the total land. The title of the book is Our Common Ground, A History of America's Public Lands. The author is John Leshy, the Emeritus Professor at the University of California, Hastings College of Law. He's been our guest. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
When we come back, how does the history of public lands influence our contemporary debate on the use of these lands? Stay with us. This is the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. Public lands are one of the collectively owned riches of Americans. How has President Joe Biden advanced the cause of public lands? And how is this different from other presidents? Doug Becker explores.
I'm Doug Becker. Under the Trump administration, public lands were privatized at a rather alarming rate. This included some very high-profile cases, including the Alaska National Wildlife Refuge, or ANWR, and several tracts in the western U.S. Joe Biden ran in part on a promise to reverse some of these decisions. But does his record in his first year in office match the campaign promises? We explore the current state of drilling, privatization, use of public lands with Mark Squillace. He is the Raphael J. Moses Professor of Natural Resources Law at the University of Colorado Law School. He is the co-author of Natural Resources Law and Policy, The Judicial Assault on the Clean Water Act, and Embracing a Civic Republican Tradition in Natural Resources Decision-Making. Thank you very much for joining us. I guess the first question is, there's a perception that the Trump administration was fairly uniquely hostile to the protection of public lands. Is that an accurate perception? And if not, what's a better way to think of it?
Thanks, Doug, for having me. Looking forward to the discussion about our public lands. So I think it is fair to criticize the Trump administration for the approach that they took to public lands. There certainly were a lot of decisions that, from my perspective, were problematic. If you think about, for example, the Anwar situation that you talked about, Trump did basically open up those lands to leasing. I think Biden has taken steps now to close those lands. And if we go outside the field of oil and gas development, you can look at places like the Tongass National Forest, where again, Trump took major steps to try to open that important forest as a carbon sink to logging. And Biden, I think, is working to go back to where we were before, where most of that forest or what remains of it is protected. So there are plenty of examples, I think, of Trump sort of opening up our public lands in ways that are problematic. I guess I would take issue a bit with your comment about privatization. I just want to be sure we're accurate here. What we're not talking about is turning over public lands wholesale to private developers. We're talking about leases, which are for a term, and presumably those the land goes back or it is recaptured essentially by the federal government after the leases develop. That's not to say that that the leases aren't a problem. Certainly, while the lease is operating, it does sort of remove the land from other kinds of uses, recreation or maybe other kinds of development even. But I wouldn't call it privatization. I think it's a little bit, I would just want to be sure we're accurate about that.
Absolutely. Is this question about providing, you know, mining, drilling access, other types of access to private corporations on these public lands, is this a largely partisan question where it's, you know, fair to say Democrats tend to be more supportive of protection of private lands, Republicans, at least in the contemporary context, tend to be more supportive of economic, you know, use of those lands?
I think there is that kind of breakdown. It's gotten complicated, I would say, because of the debate over climate change and also just the fact that the prices for oil and gas in particular have been so volatile over the past several years and indeed for quite a long time. So the picture is a little more complicated than that, but there's no doubt that the Democratic Party is more inclined to want to conserve our public lands for other kinds of uses. And the Republican Party historically has championed the development of those resources, even with the concern that we may be facing some serious challenges with climate change. And so there is that kind of divide, I guess, between the two parties. I do think, though, that we should be thinking about these issues in a little more sort of complex way than historically we've been looking at these things. And I guess what I'd suggest is that maybe we talk a little bit about some of the reforms that the Interior Department is currently considering with respect to oil and gas development, and maybe some that they're not considering that perhaps they should be considering, because I think that's really where the conversation ought to be. And frankly, I don't think we've had enough conversation about the potential changes that could happen with the oil and gas business.
Yeah, since you raised the issue, you know, of some of these reforms, what are some of the key reforms and, you know, are there ways they're not going far enough?
So a lot of it revolves around money, but money helps us to sort of figure out what people are really valuing. So if you think about our current situation on public lands with oil and gas leasing, there are about a little over, I think, 26 million acres under oil and gas lease right now on our public lands. Less than half of that is actually being developed. Just a little more than half is currently not being developed. It could be developed, but for whatever reason, people are not developing those other 13. It's something like 13.9 million acres are not being developed right now. And what that means is that we don't really need a whole lot more leasing on our public lands because there's already a lot of land under lease that could be developed that's not being developed. And I think we have to ask the question, why is it that we have all of these lands that are under lease, but that are not being developed? But, and by the way, those lands are being tied up so that they cannot be used for recreation and other purposes because the oil and gas company essentially kind of has a monopoly, at least for the term of the lease. So what can we do to maybe minimize the impact of those existing leases and maybe to see some of these leases removed from our public lands? Well, a couple of things. One is we could increase the annual rental rate that oil and gas companies pay for holding those lands. So currently they pay $1.50 for the first few years, and then it goes up to $2 an acre. It's a per acre kind of fee that they pay to rent those lands while they're not developing them. I would raise that annual rental fee substantially because what the small rental fee encourages is speculation. you're not paying a whole lot of money to hold the lease over a long period of time. You're more incentivized to just keep the lease and see if perhaps in some future date you might want to develop that lease. So you could raise those annual rental payments right from the get-go. And sort of related to the funding or the financial side of this are royalty payments. So if you look at the royalties on public lands, the Mineral Leasing Act, which governs these oil and gas leases, was passed in 1920. And it essentially sets a rate of at least 12.5% for royalties from the production of oil and gas. But the statute is clear that the Interior Department could raise the rate beyond 12.5%. We've never done it since 1920. Meanwhile, other states on their own state lands have substantially increased their royalty rates. Colorado, my home state, for example, has a 20% royalty rate. And you might be surprised that Texas actually has a 25% royalty rate on its state lands. And the Government Accountability Office did a study a number of years ago, which suggests that those increases in royalties on state lands did not really have much effect on production. So we're not talking about shutting down the oil and gas industry if we increase royalty rates, but we are talking about probably reducing production to some extent because some more marginal leases might not be developed. That might be a good thing. But even if we marginally decrease production, we would likely increase revenues. The GAO suggested that we could increase revenues substantially by increasing royalty rates to say 20%. The rate, by the way, for offshore oil and gas is 18.75%. And there's been some suggestion that the onshore rate should be the same, or at least the same. And so we could have that debate about royalties as well. There are a number of other issues that really need to be confronted. Right now, you can, if the government puts up lands for leases, as they're sort of required to do every quarter in every state where there are lands available, they basically set a minimum bid of $2 per acre. And particularly as there was the downturn in the oil and gas industry, they were often selling those leases for that minimum bid of $2 an acre. It doesn't seem to me that we should be auctioning off our public land for oil and gas development at such a low rate. I would substantially raise the bid price to ensure that only people who are serious about developing those oil and gas leases are prepared to bid on them. A few other things that we need to be thinking about here. There's a huge problem with bonding on our public lands. It's worse really on private lands, but I've always thought that we should model good behavior on our public lands. And we have a lot of abandoned wells, on our public lands that are going to need fixed. We need to plug these wells because they release methane when they're not properly reclaimed. And the land around a lot of these sites needs to be reclaimed as well. It's a very expensive enterprise to go back in 10 or 20 years after a well has been abandoned. And so that kind of work really needs to start right away. And if we had a better bonding program, we could insist that the developer paid for the cost of reclaiming those lands and plugging those wells. You may know, or you may be familiar, Doug, with the idea that the Build Back Better bill, and even before it, the infrastructure bill that was passed by Congress does have some money in it for reclaiming these abandoned wells. I think there's something like $5 billion or close to it in the bill that would allow for the government to start working on reclaiming these abandoned wells. Well, you know, that's great, and we ought to be doing that. But I do think that there's a problem with that. These problems were created by the oil and gas industry. And it's frustrating to me, at least, to think that we're not demanding that the oil and gas industry come up with a fund to help pay these costs. So in the coal business, we have something called the Abandoned Mine Reclamation Program, where for every ton of coal that's developed, there's a fee that's paid to the government to help cover the cost of reclaiming abandoned mines. And there's no reason in the world that we shouldn't do the same thing for oil and gas development. You could put a small tax on the cost or on the production of oil and gas on our public lands. Indeed, you could do it for all lands, public and private. And you could use that money, set up a fund, use that money to help cover the cost of plugging these abandoned wells. So I think that would be an important reform. And again, the government is going to be doing something in this area because of the legislation that was passed. They will likely get a lot more money if the Build Back Better bill is passed. But again, I'm not sure that the best way to do it is with public money. We ought to be thinking about doing this through the private sector and having them help to pay the costs of this reclamation work.
You're listening to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. We're discussing drilling on public lands with Mark Squillace of the University of Colorado Law School.
I know what you're describing there is what environmentalists insist the norm of polluter pays. So they're the ones doing the polluting.
A quick legal question. If you're talking about raising the rate of the lease, I imagine with the royalty question, that may be treated kind of, you know, like taxation. Are there any legal challenges? Are these contracts that have been signed? And so you're talking about raising these rates for future leases, or is there a capability to go back and the rates of the lease and the royalties, et cetera? I would say retroactively, or at least right now.
It's a really good question. It's a really good question, Doug. And the answer is we probably cannot raise the rates on existing leases. And sadly, it's because of the way that the leases were written by the federal government. They basically set the rates. I mean, one of the ironies about this problem is that the government has actually been giving what's called royalty relief to a lot of these companies, basically reducing the royalty below 12.5%, which is allowed under some limited circumstances. But the Trump administration really went whole hog in allowing this kind of royalty relief for oil and gas companies and to some extent coal companies as well. And I think that's been a real problem. I mean, there was a time, of course, when the oil and gas industry was on the ropes because of the pandemic and the decline in demand. But we're long past that. And surely the industry no longer needs, at least not right now, any kind of relief from what are really modest royalty rates that exist right now. But I'd say a couple of things about doing this going forward. One is that we certainly can impose higher royalty rates, and we must, I think, on new leases that are issued. But the other thing that could be done and that I think really should be done is focusing on these existing leases to make sure that they are no longer being held by these private developers if they're not going to develop the resource. So we have something in the law that we call diligence development requirements. And so generally with an oil and gas lease, you get 10 years to basically develop the lease and produce oil and gas in paying quantities. And if you don't produce within 10 years, you automatically lose the lease. But there are a few exceptions to that automatic loss of the lease. And there's a real problem with that right now. And it's been going on for far too many years. So if you're actively drilling on the site, you can get up to a two-year extension. That's not a huge problem. We could argue about whether they really need a two-year extension, but that's something that I don't think really creates the big problem here. But there's this other provision in the Mineral Leasing Act, which is a pretty vague provision, which basically says that the government can suspend the lease in the interest of conservation. And that phrase, in the interest of conservation, I think almost certainly was intended to mean in the interest of the conservation of the oil and gas resource. Remember, this was passed in 1920, but it has been construed by the courts to essentially include any kind of alleged environmental or conservation related interest unrelated to the oil and gas resource itself. And that kind of is an exception that you could drive a truck through. It's such a broad exception, almost anything could be conceived of as in the interest of conservation if you construe that phrase very broadly, as the government has done. But what's worse is that when a lease is suspended, you don't get any rental payments. All the fees that are otherwise paid don't come into the government. So basically, it allows companies to hold leases for as long as they can keep that suspension in place. And sadly, what the federal government has done is they've suspended a lot of these leases without notice to the public and without providing any government record of why they suspended the lease or whether the suspension was limited to a term or whether, you know, there might be some justification for taking away that suspension after a period of time because the interest of conservation has gone away. So there's been absolutely no transparency around these decisions. And there is something like 3.4 million acres of public land that is in this category of leases that should, by all rights, probably have been terminated because they were not being diligently developed, and yet the leases have been suspended. There are something like 650 leases on public lands that have been in suspension for more than 30 years. And again, that's tying up all of our public lands in ways that I think the framers of the Mineral Leasing Act never would have intended. And so I guess the point here is that the government ought to be moving much more aggressively to dealing with our existing pool of leases and making sure that if those leases aren't being developed, they're basically going back to the federal government and those leases are being terminated as they should be. And if we're going to suspend a lease in the interest of conservation, let's do it publicly. Let's give the public an opportunity to comment on the proposed suspension, the reasons for the suspension. Let's put time limits on those suspensions so that they don't go on forever. Let's make sure that if we're going to tie up our public lands in this way, that there's an adequate justification for it.
Now, last month, there was a report that environmentalists were really pretty disappointed in the Biden administration. There have been promises to reverse some of the Trump administration's support for greater leases, et cetera. And that report indicated that Biden may even be outpacing Trump in oil and gas leasing and number of leases being released. I know when she was asked about it, Jen Psaki's response was to kind of highlight some of the legal blockages of some of the Biden administration initiatives. I guess the broad question is, how disappointing has the Biden administration been on this issue?
It's been pretty disappointing, but for slightly different reasons, I think, than maybe some of the groups have articulated. And let me try to explain at least my perspective on why I think it's been disappointing. First of all, the Biden administration came out right out of the gate and issued this moratorium on new oil and gas leasing. I think that was a big mistake. I mean, it just was like a red flag to the industry that they were going to stop oil and gas leasing. And as Jen Psaki pointed out, the courts basically overturned that suspension. And as much as I might have liked the suspension to remain in place for a while, the law doesn't support the decision that the government made here. The law is pretty clear that the BLM has to hold quarterly auctions on our public lands in every state as long as there are lands that are eligible for leasing. And the way we determine eligibility is through our land use planning process. And those land use plans make lots of lands available for oil and gas leasing. So I just don't think it was credible for the government to say, we're not going to hold these quarterly auctions that are required by the statute. What they could have done, and the reason it's doubly disappointing, I guess, in terms of the approach, is they could have limited the number of leases pretty dramatically. There's no obligation to lease a particular number of leases or a particular amount of land. The BLM could have acted very carefully to look at areas that were already being significantly developed, where there are already significant kinds of impacts, and maybe allowed a handful of leases in those areas so that they wouldn't have had significant adverse effects. And instead, the BLM seems to have just sort of let the state offices, the BLM is kind of split up into various state offices around the country, and they let those state offices just propose, and they let the industry, frankly, which nominates tracts for auction, they sort of let the industry dictate which lands were going to be open to auction, and then the BLM went ahead and auctioned those lands. I just think it was a lost opportunity after they kind of botched the whole moratorium thing, and I think made a mistake there. They didn't take the opportunity to sort of basically decide that we don't need to do a lot of leasing here. You could say maybe slow walk the leasing process a bit. Again, recognizing that we already have a lot of land under lease that could be developed. I think the Center for American Progress estimated that there's enough land under lease on our public lands to allow development to occur through 2030. And so, you know, there's plenty of land under lease that could be developed. Maybe we should lease a few more parcels around the country in various states. I don't necessarily oppose that. Again, if you think about the federal government's role in oil and gas development, it's not a bad thing if the federal government is forced to kind of model the way in which good practices are done. One of the things that I think is kind of an interesting reason to allow some level of development on our public lands is that the federal government can require stricter kinds of environmental controls on how oil and gas leasing is done. So the way oil and gas leasing works is that you first get this lease, you purchase it from the federal government, and then if you want to develop that lease, you file what's called an application for a permit to drill. Just an APD is what we usually call it. And when the government decides whether or not to approve that APD, they can put whatever kinds of stipulations or conditions they want on that development. And they could require, for example, a really robust program to capture the methane. They've been struck down on their rules for capturing methane, but there's nothing to stop the federal government from imposing these conditions on an individual case-by-case basis when they get these kinds of applications. And I think the Interior Department has not been terribly creative in thinking about how they might restrict development if they want to do that, or if development is going to occur, how they can make sure that it's done in an environmentally friendly way.
That's a good place to stop in thinking of ways to creatively manage this question about the use of public lands, and in particular, this question about leasing. So thank you very much for joining us. We've been exploring the current state of drilling and the use of private lands with Mark Squillace. He is the Raphael J. Moses Professor of Natural Resources Law at the University of Colorado's Law School. He's the co-author of Natural Resources Law and Policy and the Judicial Assault on the Clean Water Act and Embracing a Civic Republican Tradition in Natural Resources Decision-Making. Thank you very much for joining us.
And that's it for today's program. Thank you for listening. The Scholar Circle is hosted by Doug Becker. Its managing producers are Ankina Agassian and Melissa Chiprin. Seth Dongre is our webmaster and assistant producer. Our archives are at scholarcircle.org, and our podcasts are on Apple and Google Podcasts and iTunes. Please follow us on @ScholarCircle or me @Armudian and join our Facebook page. I'm the founder, anchor, and occasional host, Maria Armudian.